Hi, everyone. This is Austin welcoming you to the LL Research Radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Thursday, February 26th, 2015. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites, the archive website llresearch.org and the community website bringforth.org. Together they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody with us and ready to go?
We are.
More or less.
Ready to go.
All righty. Our opening riff today comes from a quote from the session from July 6th, 1986. And Kuo says, "For each of you is a mirror in likeness, not similar but the same, so that your other selves may gaze within your glass and see what they need to see about themselves. Indeed, it is often among your peoples that you see things in other people, not realizing that you are seeing the reflection of yourself."
Thank you. Thank you, Austin. We always feel that we're quite unique. Pardon the redundancy. We are unique. There's no one like us anywhere. We think our own thoughts. We do our own things. And when we share, we are being quite original in what we say. And yet, there is us to us that is irresistible. We're humans. That much goes without saying. We're part of that small company of humankind, shares the planet, that shares our thoughts, our dreams, our hopes. And so we carry on. Jim, how are you today?
You're asking me?
Are you not on the air?
Yes. Did you want me to comment on the riff?
Oh, the riff. I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted today. I was commenting on the riff, was I not?
Right.
That we're all completely alike. That that we even forget similarly, if not the same. It's a little distracting sometimes to realize that we really are alike. We're not just similar, but we're alike. How unusual to be alike in the midst of our own uniqueness. It's the way it works. We share back and forth because We can. We know what we're talking about. We understand each other. I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted today. Jim, can you take over for me?
Well, I'll give it a shot. I've had the hardest time imagining how I can see myself in other people. But I know that's the way it works. That whatever we like or seem to dislike in some other person is a reflection of those qualities that are in ourselves. And that's the reason we're noticing them in the other person. If you talk to a third party about this person you're noticing, they might find another way of looking at the person because they have got their own lens through which they look. And I have to remind myself of this fact because it's too easy to look at something I see as a failure in somebody else and to criticize them for it and then to kind of put it aside and not have to deal with it anymore because, you know, it's their problem, it's their characteristic. And but when you get right down to it, it's not just theirs. It's your impression is all over it. The lens that you create with your beliefs is what causes you to see that there. So it's very helpful if you're willing to face the truth that may not be that comfortable. It's a lot easier to try to see the positive sides of yourself in other people and to be able to admit that. But to admit that there is some sort of a difficulty there, that's the real trick. And I think that that's something we face every day. And we can learn from that. And not just the faces of people that we see, but the situations we find ourselves in. I don't think there are any mistakes, just like Ross said. We find ourselves being reflected back by the faces we see and by the situations that we find ourselves participating in and how we're doing it. And if we can keep that foremost in our minds and in our hearts, then we might be able to pick up a few more clues as to how our spiritual growth is going or which direction it's headed in. Do you have any final thoughts on that, sweetie?
No, I think you're doing wonderfully well. Why don't we go to the first question if you're done?
I'm done.
All right.
Anybody else have a comment on that, by the way?
Sure. That's one of my favorite topics, actually. You called this projection, and it is probably the best way we can learn about ourselves is through interacting with other people and trying to figure out both what we really like about other people and what we really dislike about other people. It goes both ways. A lot of times people tend to take the negative approach and just say, well, if you don't like something about somebody, it's yourself. But it's also when you have a personal hero or somebody that you really look up to, that is also projection because those qualities the person has that are positive are also qualities that you innately possess in yourself. If not actively, then at least in potential, and you can access those things. And just understanding that when you look at somebody, you admire them, and they are doing really good things in the world and are everything that you want to be, knowing that the fact you can even recognize that within that person means that you yourself can access that potential and become what you desire to be that they are giving an example of. So I really like the reflective nature of our reality, and I think it's what gives us the most personal growth. Gary, do you have any personal thoughts on projection and reflection?
No, you guys did wonderfully.
All righty. Well, thank you, Jim and Carla, for the opening riff. We can go to our questions now that were sent in. The first one from user Piscean Joy on bringforth.org. Piscean Joy writes, "My husband is a gun owner and strongly desires I keep and carry firearms for self-defense, especially now that we have a small child and reside in a rural area where I am often home alone with her. Despite all the training and safe gun ownership tools he is placing at my disposal and his very logical reasoning for it, this just doesn't sit well with me. Am I naive in ignoring his practical reasoning, or is my inner guidance telling me what the universe needs me to know? Does Ra or any of your channelings address this issue on any level? Intuitively, I assume owning any tool designed to harm others is negatively polarizing, and that owning a gun for self-defense is allowing fear to rule one's life. That we are not them trusting... I messed up writing that down there. Are we not then trusting in divine protection? I mean, prudence is one thing, but I suspect gun ownership may take prudence to another level. Thank you all so much. Love and blessings. Thank you for the question, Piscean Joy. Anybody want to take first dibs on that question?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that I think that it's perfectly okay to have a gun in the house. It does not penetrate what you yourself are doing. If there is a weapon of mass destruction in the house, as long as you just let it lie where it is and let your husband be happy and know that it's there and that in the event you would do the right thing and you would wait until that very moment to see what that right thing was for you. That doesn't mean you have to pick it up. That doesn't mean you have to do anything with it. It just means that you're getting along with your husband. And that's the way we do these things in marriage. We say, okay, sweetie, I'll have the gun in the house. I won't promise to use it, but I feel that it's necessary, then I will. And that should be the end of it, because how often does something drastic happen like that? I think, you know, you can just put it out of sight, out of mind, and forget about it, because it's not going to come up. But that's probably the way I would handle it. I would be diplomatic. I would say, okay, society, nothing's going to happen that requires the use of a gun. And if it does, well, there it is. We have it. All right. Jim, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about that. I kind of like the idea, because I was without that concept in mind of just having the gun there and ignoring it. I was trying to figure out what she ought to do about her inner voice, because it's obviously telling her that it's not a good idea to have a gun. But then if she's going to be living with a husband who wants her to have a gun, she's got this pull on her to do something along that line. And, you know, your suggestion of just keeping the gun there might work.
I think that that is the problem right there, is that you have a husband that thinks that he should have one, whereas you are so far out of kilter with him one or another. And that's unfortunate. So I think a good, strong conversation needs to happen between husband and wife as to, you know, one final settlement about this particular situation.
Well, I have a hunch, looking at the first line, that they've already had this conversation, and he's the traditional male that gives orders, and basically that's what he's done. So I think she's stuck with the guy. I don't think she's going to change his mind, but we can always hope.
Oscar, can you hear Carla?
I was about to say, before I get to my thoughts, I think Carla's microphone may have fallen away from her face or something, because she sounds very faint on this end.
Oh.
Yeah, really, yeah. Faint, too.
I see it.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
That's much better. We could hear what you were saying, but it was just very, very quiet. I do have some thoughts about gun ownership. The first one I'll start off is just something that I thought was really interesting about how Tibetan monks and monks in Asia took up the art of martial arts and practicing with weapons, because it seems sort of contradictory to have these tools of violence at their hands when they're supposed to be very pacifist and very spiritual people. And that is that they found that in their pacifism and in their sort of lack of ability to defend themselves, they were being taken advantage of. When they would carry their goods on travels, they would be attacked by bandits and thieves who could pretty much just kill all of them and take all of their stuff without any kind of resistance. And so the monks decided we need to do something about this and decided to basically perfect a form of martial arts and used it in more of a spiritual way and used the opportunity of martial arts to deepen their spiritual philosophy and basically having this potential for power at their hands and deciding when and how to use it would be best. And so they learned to defend themselves with weapons and with martial arts, and that basically made them sort of a force to be reckoned with whenever they were transporting their goods, and basically allowed them the ability of self-preservation as opposed to just giving in to the violence that was being given to them. This is obviously a different kind of society. They lived in very different times, and where it was not uncommon for you to be walking down the road and mugged by a bandit. I think you're a lot less likely nowadays to be attacked in your home, but it still happens sometimes, and I don't think that it's necessarily a blanket negative thing for somebody to own a weapon or something that's meant for harm. There was one Kuo session I found where somebody actually asked a question very similar to this, basically asking if owning a gun was innately negative. And this was from the session on January 4th, 1987. It was a very short question and answer, so I'll read the entire answer that Kuo gave for this question. They say, there is no artifact of your culture, including the weapons of which you speak, which in itself may bring an entity a situation which you would describe as dangerous or negative. Rather, one may look to the intentions of the one who possesses the artifact and query as to the nature of those intentions. For though your world is one composed of many things and seems concrete and solid about you, indeed that which moves it and has affected upon it is of the world of thought. As you direct your thoughts, so you draw unto that which resonates in harmony with those thoughts. This is a general principle which, of course, has many exceptions, but one may look to it as what you may call a rule of thumb. We may also add that the intentions which motivate any action are intentions which are themselves a product of what an entity has thus far learned within an incarnation and the efficiency with which that learning has been accomplished. Thus, the frame of mind and mood of emotion become the motivators for further actions and further thoughts, as they themselves are products of the experience of the entity. So then incarnation builds a certain momentum, shall we say, and it is within this field of thought energy that an entity will draw unto itself those experiences which are most likely to provide it further opportunities for learning and being of service. So I get two things from that. Basically, Kuo saying that it's not a blanket negative thing to own a gun, but also the thoughts and the intentions of owning the gun will inform the experiences which you will have with that gun, essentially. So it may be a thing that can inflict violence upon others, but if you are using it for self-defense, and it really depends on where that self-defense is coming from. If you are in constant fear and you truly feel you need to protect yourself from some sort of looming threat, that might inform your experience. If you are just aware that there's a small chance that your house looks lucrative to some sort of violent criminal and that you will have it sitting there just in case and never thinking about it until you need it, that will inform it. But I would tell Piscean Joy that I wouldn't suggest to ignore your inner guidance, because we always have those intuitive pulls for a reason and intuitive notions, but they're not always exact, and they can always be informed by our previous biases and our previous thoughts. And so I would say, instead of just sort of looking at it as a black and white situation, try to dive into this guidance that you're feeling to shy away from the gun and try to figure out what exactly it is that scares you about the gun, why you feel it might be such a negative thing, and figure out your previous experiences that drew this situation to you where there seems to be a conflict between you and your husband, because it's probably a very ripe catalyst for some self-growth and self-discovery there. And you may come out the other end with a different opinion on guns or with more information to give your husband on how you feel about what he's asking you to do. Gary, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, Great response, Austin. Can understand where the husband is coming from. When you love something or someone, you want them protected and safe from harm, especially in a mental sort of climate that this world seems to be in, that sends us messages that there is harm around every corner. But in a realistic assessment of the world, there are negatively oriented entities in this world, those who have polarized or are polarizing, service of self. And there's also those people who are just confused or disturbed or emotionally imbalanced and who will do negative things. So the question then becomes how best to protect oneself against those sorts of influences in the world. And if you look at the raw material, it does have a theme running here and there of protection. The group initiated a protection ritual at the start of it in order to protect the instrument and the group and the contact from intrusion of negative influence. And Ross speaks about protection here and there. They say that love is a great protector, but also they encourage the group to do these specific rituals as a means of protection. But as was true in the group's case, and as was present in Austin's response and Jim and Carlos, the group wasn't living from a mindset of fear. They weren't too anxious or worried or fearful or apprehensive about these negative entities. They just took the practical, reasonable measures to protect themselves and then went on about their business. I think that is the key I would focus in on when trying to answer this question for myself, is what is my mindset? You say Piscean joy in the section of your question, owning a gun for self-defense is allowing fear to rule one's life. I think it's entirely possible to have a gun and not be a fearful person. Like Carla says, have that item in your house and put it in a drawer or wherever is safe, and then kind of forget about it. Don't live with a fearful mindset, but invoke faith. And I heard this wonderful expression somewhere, and I ran a quick search on the net, didn't have time, couldn't find it, but it went something like, trust God, but keep your hand on your wallet. I think one can have a overall vibration of faith, but simultaneously take practical measures to protect oneself. And while the entity grows and while you learn and evolve, and then eventually maybe there is some sort of state of mind or state of vibration whereby you feel absolutely no need to protect yourself. You will enter into a beehive with no protection. I think of enlightened entities, and I am aware of no stories of enlightened beings walking around with some kind of defensive mechanism or some kind of weapon of violence like a gun. But at the same time, I think of the excellent illustration that Austin drew of Eastern monks and meditators who took martial arts as a means of defense. And I don't see those people living in a state of fear, but I see them, again, taking those practical measures. But that's pretty much my response. And I would suggest, as potentially, if the gun, if the question of the gun proves too unsettling for you, and no matter what kind of inner work you do, you just don't want it in the house, you could also explore non-lethal measures of protection, like mace, for instance, and I'm sure there are many others out there. Sorry guys, real quick, one more thought, and that's that the metaphysics of the situation, which you were getting to, Piscean joy, are: is the owning a gun attracting a negative situation to me? And that's been a question for me when it comes to the locked door question. do I lock my door in order to protect what's inside, but in so doing, does that attract the criminal? Or if I decide to be completely vulnerable and express faith that in vulnerability there is protection and I don't need to mechanically or artificially protect myself, then I leave the door unlocked, and then the criminal, then suddenly the house is not metaphysically appealing to the criminal. It's been a conundrum because I don't know precisely how the mechanics of the metaphysical universe operate in that regard. But in the end, I err on the side of being with a deadbolt just to play it safe. And that's it for me.
When we first bought this house back in 1984, the lady that we were buying it from had to look for about 30 minutes to find the key because in the 17 years they'd lived here, they'd never locked it. So we continued that probably for the last 30 years, I guess. And then in the last, not quite year, I think there's been some break-ins in the neighborhood because we have a orphanage close to us, and some of the older kids have been running around the neighborhood and just, you know, maybe kicking a door in and taking a television or something. Nothing big. They're not professional or anything. So I decided just to start locking the door front and back so that I would be protected against this smash and, you know, run sort of thing that's going on, not thinking that there would be anything else to worry about. So that's, we've kind of been on both sides, I guess, in our response here.
Yeah, I have an anecdote which touches upon the locked door thing that Gary's talking about, which I guess is sort of tangentially related to this question, and that when I first went through my spiritual awakening, I really got into this law of attraction sort of thing, where if you consider something and you think about something and you prepare for something, you're attracting it to yourself. And so I took that method of not protecting my things and not even considering the fact that somebody could steal them. And within about a six-month period, I had a series of people stealing all my stuff. And by the end of it, my video game systems were gone, my laptop was gone, and a lot of my material goods had disappeared. And the fact that I did not protect them did not, in fact, protect them.
Right.
So I think that we're living, fortunately at that time I was also at a space of being able to let go of my material things, and the fact that these things were stolen really actually didn't bug me that much. So that might have been another aspect there, is that I was ready for a purging of material goods, and it just so happened that thievery was the method behind that. But so that shows you there's a little more at play than just your intention in locking your door or your intention in carrying a gun. And I think we live in a realm that can be more random than some spiritual people would like to think, especially the law of attraction people who say we attract everything to us. I think that, you know, we're living on a planet with 7 billion other people, and every single one of those people has their own intentions. And at some point, one of those person's intentions is going to clash with your intention, and there has to be some sort of reconciliation there. Your intention not to be robbed can't necessarily override somebody's intention to rob you. So there's an aspect of practicality that I think we all sort of touched upon, but I think the key point that I've heard all of us say is just the intention and where you're coming from in owning the gun is really what you want to pay attention to, and maybe that's what should be thought about when you discuss this question with your husband. Alrighty. Any more thoughts on the gun ownership question?
I think we gave that a good chew.
I think so.
not for
Thank
me.
You. Thank you for that question, Pisces and Joy. Our next one comes from user Jeremy on Bring Forth. He asks, I recently finished reading Journey of Souls, and I'm currently reading Destiny of Souls by Michael Newton. I'm curious, if the interest during any of the raw or subsequent channeling sessions has ever turned towards how the time between incarnations is spent. I'd love to hear the Confederation's opinion on this, but I have a feeling it may have been considered transient, since it seems their message was only intended to pertain to our work within a particular incarnation or of a density. Was there any interest expressed within the group pertaining to this time in between incarnations?
We never asked about that, and we never really got any solid information about it, but we would get maybe in regard to Carla as the instrument, that the limitations she was suffering that were being accentuated by negative greeting were pre-incarnatively chosen. So the concept of making a planning for the incarnation before the incarnation was accepted. And when Carla and two of her friends were regressed by a mutual friend of Don and Carla's, they all reported independently of each other going back to a location that Dr. Newton would call the spiritual home or the spiritual family. And in Carla's case, she knew the family was just over the hill as she was going through a near-death experience. And since she was given a choice of coming back or not, and she came back, she didn't get to go see the family. So we don't know how that went. But we got indication, whatever we got concerning the time period before incarnation matches extremely well with Dr. Newton. It's just that we never tried to go that direction. And personally, before I came in contact with Dr. Newton's material, I had never really given a lot of serious thought about, well, just how would all this work? And we all accepted the fact of we have guides and a higher self and a soul, and they do play some kind of a role. You know, if we can get in contact with them during the incarnation, we can, make the incarnation more efficient. And I just had general thoughts about that. But when I started reading what Dr. Newton and other authors have to say about that time, it just made so much sense that, there is an order to it. There's a structure to it, the way it works. And we have assistance. And we, as soon as the veil is dropped, everything becomes clearer. And we see the unity of all things and what we next need to do according to what we've done with previous incarnations. So there wasn't a whole lot of information that came through either the raw contact or any other channelings that we had, because in my case, and I think it would be true for a lot of others as well, we just didn't have good enough information to ask about. We're just sort of taking it all on faith that, good things will happen there, and, I won't worry about it.
There were, like Jim said, there was not a whole lot in the raw material about in between incarnations, but there were some very small bits that whenever it was related, Ra might say something about time in between incarnations. And there were a couple themes that were very consistent, and that is the idea of healing, apparently healing and review of the previous incarnation that they had just experienced as a big part of what Ra described as in between incarnations. And then as Jim said, the planning of the incarnation was sort of hinted at within the raw material. And I've got a few quotes here that I'll read just because they're relevant and they're interesting where Ra talks about this. The first one coming from Session 21, Question 9, Ra says, "Thus the time, as you may understand it, between incarnations is lengthened to give appropriate attention to the review and the healing of experiences of the previous incarnation. At some point in third density, the Green Ray Energy Center becomes activated, and at that point, incarnation ceases to be automatic." So I was talking there about when we, instead of our higher selves planning our incarnation, once we activate the Green Ray Energy Center, the planning of our incarnation falls on us. Instead of it being sort of guided by our guides, we play an active role in that, which I think is an interesting point. Then in Session 71, Question 6, Ra said, "In these metaphysical planes, there is a great deal of what you call time, which is used to review and re-review the biases and learning teaching of a prior, as you would call it, space-time incarnation." And then in Session 83, Question 7, this is the last one I have, Ra says, "It is true that the nature of time-space is such that a lifetime may be seen whole as a book or record, the pages studied, rifled through, and reread. However, the value of review is that of the testing as opposed to the studying. At the testing, when the test is true, the distillations of all study are made clear. During the process of study, which you may call the incarnation, regardless of an entity's awareness of the process taking place, the material is diffused, and overattention is almost inevitably placed upon detail. The testing upon the cessation of the incarnative experience, incarnative state, is not that testing which involves the correct memorization of many details. This testing is, rather, the observing of self by self, often with aid, as we have said. It is in this observation one sees the sum of all the detailed study, that being an attitude or complex of attitudes which bias the consciousness of the mind-body-spirit complex. So I like that sort of analogy, too, in that the incarnation is the studying and the in-between incarnation is the test. And it's a sort of loose analogy. I don't think it goes very well with the way our academic system works, where you memorize facts and then you regurgitate those facts onto a test to get a good grade. But I do think it is interesting. Gary, did you have anything to say about that one?
Well, Jim spoke to why the group didn't question on that topic during the raw contact. But so the only thing I would have to add is in response to Jeremy's thought that perhaps the material was transient, and I wouldn't consider information regarding life between lives as being of a transient nature. I think in connection to the quote that Austin just read, there's a distillation of the incarnation. There's a revealing of the actual self, and or at least a truer version of the self, and the intentions for the upcoming incarnation and the planning and the review of the previous incarnation. I think it's a very interesting and non-transient time period or window to focus on in one's soul evolution, because it reveals a lot about the self, where the self has been, where the self is going, and who the self is.
And the connection with all other beings is especially emphasized in the experience that each soul has between incarnations, that, you know, it's a universe of unity, for one thing, and it's a universe of love, that there is no judgment, and there's no right or wrong, and there are no mistakes. They're just opportunities to learn, and people are more or less successful depending upon how they respond during the incarnation. And sometimes they have no idea, most of the times, we have no idea how we're doing. And it's only after we've gone through the doors of death and dropped the veil and looked back, we discover, wow, you know, did a lot better than I thought, or could have done a little better there. It's really hard to get the temperature.
What you say makes it apparent to me that if we on Earth had never received information or teaching from a density higher than our own, and all we ever had access to in terms of philosophy and insight into the universe was information that came from life between lives, I think that alone would be a basis for a very beautiful philosophy and understanding of life.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in connection to the things that Jim just said about the unity of all things and the non-judgmental nature and the desire to learn and to grow.
That is an interesting point to go on to our next question, but before we do, I want to check with Carla to see if there's anything she would like to say about it first.
Carla had to ring off because she was not feeling really well, and she also wasn't hearing very well, so
okay,
we'll have to go on without her.
Sounds good. We'll keep on plugging away at these questions then. So in regards to the unity that we become aware of in between incarnations, Cloth sent in an email asking, as of lately, I've been thinking a lot about the process of physical death and what happens after. I'm familiar with Michael Newton's work regarding this, which I believe quite accurately fits with Ra's explanations regarding the matter. However, both Michael Newton and Ra seem to describe the process from a service to others' point of view. I'm having a hard time imagining the process for a service to self-oriented entity. For when you pass on and the veil is dropped, how can a service to self attitude be maintained when supposedly the creation reveals itself as one?
I think all we can do here is, you know, give our own opinions as to what might be happening, because we don't know. Dr. Newton says that he's never seen a negatively oriented entity, doesn't believe in evil, and therefore that, you know, that is the way he looks at things. And Robert Schwartz, who writes on the same topic, says he does believe that, you know, negative entities exist, and he has seen possession of souls by others that were negative. I've been thinking about it along the way since, you know, we've been reading these books for a while, and I have a hunch that the negatively oriented entity, because he has to be, or she, so purely negative, 95% or more, doesn't go through this same process. Once we ask Ra about that shift that negative entities need to make at mid-sixth density, or, you know, do they ever make contact with their higher soul beforehand, and since their higher soul or their higher self is positive, then how would they, you know, balance that in their negatively oriented minds? And Ra said, well, what is the first separation? Well, the nature of negativity is separation. And what is the first separation? Self from self. So they don't necessarily contact their higher selves. They go on their own power and wisdom. And what exactly they do when they die, who knows? But I do know that a number of entities that we would consider negative, and Ra mentioned this, was Himmler, one of the deputies under Hitler in World War II. And I believe, was it Goebbels? And there was one other guy. They all took their own lives, and they were considered adepts of the negative nature. And they took their own lives, I do believe, because control is also a feature of negativity. And so they controlled their own death. And they were aware beforehand, consciously, that this would be the way for them to further their own needs. You can be pretty certain that they were aware of what to do, because, I mean, 95% negative is a whole lot of wisdom pointed toward the self. So they've got to have some other process, some other way of moving forward. And I think that it has to do with the ability to dominate and control those around them. So when they see the light, they have to be able to control it somehow. And anybody else have any ideas?
Yeah, when they see the light, they say, no, I'm going into that tunnel on my own time. And stand there and wait. And yeah, it's a really, there's hardly anything to go on. And like Jim began his response by saying, like, we can only really put forth our opinions and guess, I would add. The one piece of headway that I was going to make into this question, Jim already referenced, and it comes from 36.14, and it's about Himmler. And I'm going to repeat what some of Jim said, but there's a little nuance added by reading the whole thing. The question is, was Himmler in any way in contact with his higher self at that time while he was incarnate in the 1940s? And Ra responds, we remind you that the negative path is one of separation. What is the first separation? The self from the self. Jim has very good memory. the one known as Himmler did not choose to use its abilities of will and polarization to seek guidance from any source but its conscious drive, self-chosen in the life experience and nourished by previous biases created in other life experiences. So the negative entity, if Himmler is an example, is a representative example of the negative polarity foregoes guidance from others. So actually, come to think of it, Ra does say that negative beings on this planet do contact higher density negative beings in order to gain teaching from those negative beings. So maybe it's an individual choice that the negative entity makes whether to turn to guidance or not turn to guidance. But either way, if there is a turning to some form of guidance, it will be only on the negative entity's own terms. And like Jim was saying, the negative entity will seek to control things, so the negative being would, I presume, seek to try to control the source of the guidance or the information coming through in some way. But once that negative entity dies and enters into the time-space realms, like Jim was saying, there must be some kind of mechanics or structure or procedure. And I would imagine the negative entity isn't completely alone, but has, and I'm only speculating, the negative being has others of the same polarity in those realms with it, somehow assisting it. But I don't know.
This reminds me of the time when Carla was under attack during the sessions, when the entity, session 68 through 72, when the negative-oriented fifth density entity was hoping to lead her mind-by-spirit complex astray, you know, to bring it into negative time-space. And when Don was asking about this whole situation, it was revealed that for a positively-oriented entity to be in negative time-space would be the same as to be in total darkness, that there really wouldn't be a perception of entities or energies. It would be dark. And the dilemma then of the higher self of that entity would be to allow it then to incarnate into negative space-time so that the polarity could be eventually reversed after, of course, becoming basically negative. But then doing it with the purpose in mind of eventually reversing it back to the positive polarity. But then the positive entity would find itself surrounded in a very hostile environment and would have to blend in with it. So I'm trying to connect that to the pre-incarnative or time between incarnative experiences that the negative entity would go through. And obviously they have their own place. And to a positive entity, it would be negative. Maybe that's why Dr. Newton's clients seldom report seeing anything of a negative nature, because negative entities would probably not be visible to them for the same reason.
I think so. I think that a positive entity and a negative entity exist in different sorts of time spaces. Their mentality places them in either a positive time space or a negative time space, something along those natures. There has to be some sort of way for them to both incarnate on Earth at the same time. But Ra says that in time space, like attracts like. And so it's unlikely that if you are of a positive nature, you'll see people of a negative nature. One thought I had, based off of what you guys were saying, and the crux of Klaus's question basically is, how can, once the oneness is revealed to this negative entity, how can they continue on this negative path? And the first thing I would say is that the path of service to self or service to others is a bias that you gain within an incarnation. You can't make that choice outside of incarnation. It's something. It's the reason that we incarnate, essentially. And basically, as we interpret catalyst and utilize catalyst within our incarnation, we either tend to go more and more positive and more negative, and then we reach a certain point where we are essentially polarized positively or negatively. And I have a feeling that once a negative entity, once the oneness is revealed to them, that knowledge is then utilized based upon that bias. When a positive entity views oneness, they view it in compassion and view everything as equal and having everything a part of an equal creator. But when a negative entity grasps oneness, and I think that they do, I think that it's knowledge that they don't necessarily ignore, but they view it differently. They interpret that information in a negative sense, to where everything is one, and so I have dominion over all of this because it's all me. And everything is me, and so I have the right, the ability, and the will to have control over all of this singular me. And I think that there was a quote that I had that's slightly related. Yeah, Ra says, "Those which have chosen the service to self path have simply used the veiling process in order to potentiate that which is not. This is an entirely acceptable method of self-knowledge of and by the Creator." And so at that point, the veiling process becomes another tool of the service to self entity to further control themselves and the people around them and their environment. So I think that's essentially why, once the oneness is revealed to the service self entity, they continue upon this path, is that they realize the oneness, but they interpret it differently because negative interpretation is different from positive interpretation. There's negative wisdom and there's positive wisdom. And negative wisdom utilizes more information to promote control and basically disintegration. And positive wisdom uses it to unify and bring everything together. And that's probably the best that I can think of. I think there's another interesting aspect where Ra says that once a positive entity activates Green Ray, they start creating their own experiences. There must be some equivalent to the negative entity where, since they don't necessarily activate Green Ray, there must be some amount of light that they are then able to start planning their own incarnation. And like Gary was talking about, they might tend to forego the guidance of their higher self and really start to plan their own incarnation without the help of others. But based on other sources, especially if you get into the conspiracy side of things, which who knows how much of it is true or which is not, but there are certain families which tend to hold elite status and incarnate within the same family again and again in order to maintain their elite self-serving status. So there might be a group of self-serving entities who intend to work together, because Ross said that both for positive and negative, the male and female combination tends to be a very effective way of polarizing. So there's probably groups of service self entities that work together to gain power for the group and for themselves, as opposed to how service to others groups work together. And that's just the speculation, like we've been saying. There's no way we can really know. Any more thoughts on Klaus's question there?
Yeah, negative beings don't... I mean, they are their own number one. Like you said, used a great word, dominion. They see everything as being of their dominion, or at least potentially. So, in a sense, they're isolated, cut off, and separated, but they do see the advantage of working together, and they form alliances and partnerships, the difficulty being the entropy that results from the constant competition and working against. But nevertheless, they do operate within larger organizations, such as the Orion Empire. So you would have to presume that that carries over into time-space in some way, because time-space is populated by entities. And you posed a really intriguing notion that hadn't quite crystallized in my own mind, and that's that in time-space, at least in the third density realm, there is no objective universe, per se. It's an interpreted universe, or it's a universe filtered through the biases of the polarities, so that the positive polarity sees things through a positive lens, which is a closer approximation of what is, or a closer approximation of the objective universe, whereas the negative polarity will filter and see things through their own bias lens. And Jim was noting that Michael Newton doesn't believe in evil or negative beings and hadn't encountered any material that would corroborate that in his regressive hypnosis research. And you have to wonder, too, if somebody like Newton has a sort of sampling bias, I think is the term, in that he's only regressing people who are more or less positively oriented because they come to him wanting to be healed, wanting to understand themselves. Whereas a negative entity, at least someone fairly progressed along that path, wouldn't go see a past life therapist in order to access that material and better understand themselves.
Yeah, that and they're probably just so rare that it would be very odd to happen upon one randomly. If we are to believe what Ross says, that there's a lot more positive entities than negative entities, and that negative polarization is sort of an exception in this plane.
Yeah.
Alrighty, thank you for that question, Klaus. We're coming up on about 4 minutes, so I think that we can probably wrap up. Does anybody have any last thoughts or words?
Well, I will echo Carla's usual sentiments and let everybody know we love you with all our hearts, and we really appreciate all the questions that you send, and we value them and ask for more. bring on some questions, and we'll do our best to try to answer them. And we hope the winter is loosening its grip wherever you are. It looks like it might be getting a little bit warmer here soon, so let's all keep thoughts of spring in our minds.
Please. You have been listening to LL Research's In the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those of you who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, and we'll be here next Tuesday at 1 p.m., and we will talk with you then.